Hi, this is Debbie.
This is Jackie. In this episode, AADL talks to Cheryl Chattister, the curator of the Argus Museum. The museum, established in 1987, is located at 535 West 4th Street, the home of Argus Camera. This historic structure is also home to the Michigan Furniture Company. As the curator, Cheryl is responsible for the acquisition, preservation, and exhibit design of the museum. Her many duties put her in touch with Argus collectors, historians, camera clubs, and former employees that have been instrumental in building the museum's collection, as well as researching the history of Argus Camera.
Tell me a little bit about what you do as a curator for a museum.
Well, actually, I'm more than a curator because I'm the only paid employee of the museum. So I accession and catalog artifacts. I've written the loan agreements and the collection agreements and things like that. I design the display cases. I research, try to do donations to require more artifacts for the museum. We host photography shows, usually about 3 a year. I do a few outreach programs of different kind of affiliated organizations. The Ann Arbor Area Crappy Camera Club. They have shows there, and they have meetings there.
Tell us about the museum itself.
The museum is located at the Argus One building, 535 West William. It's in the second floor. It's open from 8 to 5 Monday through Friday or by appointment. And also, we have special events. They're open on weekends. We have rare cameras, military artifacts. We also have very common cameras. Everybody's grandfather had at one time. We feature some human interest stories that pertain to Argus, such as Tony Vaccaro, who was a soldier in World War II, and took a C3 camera, Argus C3 camera, to Germany and took photographs there. And we feature people like that. Milt Hinton, who was a jazz musician in the 30s and 40s, and also a wonderful photographer who started off with an Argus camera. Again, we host photography shows, and we try to feature local or regional photographers.
Now, how many items do you have in the collection?
Oh, a couple thousand, if you include all of the things in the archives.
How did the collection come together?
Well, originally, first Martin and O'Neill Construction purchased the Argus One building back in 1983, and they actually opened the building in 87. But between that time, they purchased the Don Wallace collection. The W. Don Wallace collection, who had 107 items, Argus items. And he donated his items to a partnership between First Martin and O'Neill Construction called 3C Partners. And from then, it's been all donations, really. And once in a while, I'll buy something small for the museum and donate myself, truthfully. But we have a very avid and dedicated museum members who search all around the world for rare artifacts for the museum. And also a lot of our items come from family members whose fathers or grandfathers worked for Argus or grandmothers worked for Argus. And sometimes the former employees themselves. There's people come in with their employee badges and hand them to me. And that was them, 30 years ago. It's really wonderful.
What are some of the highlights in the collection, that rare objects that you are very proud to have?
Oh, well, the rare objects are probably some of the cameras. We have a Model K, which is extremely rare, and those who have one definitely cherish it. And we have some prototypes, Model 12s, that were never produced. We have a black C4, which we believe probably 8 exist in the world. We're not sure if they're military, made for the military, but never was produced, or just some other kind of prototype. We also have, I have a couple M72 military telescopes that are used for the Sherman tanks, but one actually came in with its original packaging, original box, and it was III, and so it was like the code for Argus at the time. If it fell into the wrong hand, they wouldn't know who actually was producing those items.
What would you say is the oldest item in the...
Well, the first camera that was, well, probably is the radios, because before Argus, they produced radios, the International Radio Corporation, which was founded in 1931. And the first radios they made were the Cadets, and we have a couple of Cadets in the museum. When it comes to cameras, the first camera that was actually released was the Argus A in 1936.
And you have one of them?
Yes, we do.
Would you say you have virtually every model?
Virtually, one we don't have. I've been trying to acquire it. And somebody locally has used to work for Argus. And I've been in touch with, he's not doing well, I'm in touch with his wife and their kids in trying, pleading to acquire this camera.
Do you think there may be others?
Yes, I'll let you know. It's an Argus C5 prototype, circa 1956. It's not a real pretty camera. It's really top-heavy. Maybe it's why it was produced. But we don't have one.
Okay, can you just go through the company's timeline quickly? You mentioned the International Radio Corporation. And also, what is this Arbor phone? Do you know what that
is? Yeah, a little bit, yes. How the IRC started, International Radio Corporation started, was led by local businessmen, including William E. Brown Jr., who became a mayor. And the group raised $10,000 to found the International Radio Corporation. They made Charles Vasseur president of the company. Before Vasseur was involved in that, though, he had his own radio company, the Arbophone, which he founded in 1924. In 1932, IRC introduced the Cadet, the small, light, five-tube AC-DC radio, and it was hailed at that year the greatest set of the year in the February 1933 issue of Radio Craft magazine. In 1933, they introduced the Cadet Junior, the two-tube radio that was small enough to be carried in a coat pocket, though I've seen it's rather large coat pocket.
It's kind of like the original portable telephones.
Right, yeah, that's kind of it. And they also marketed a kit that you could use your radios in your cars. Pretty awesome. I know, yeah, pretty, you know. And in 1938, they introduced a Cadet Mystic Tune Master, at a remote control device that users could use a tune from any room in the house. And business was booming. By 1933, they had 150 employees. But in the summer months, they didn't make a lot of radios because radios were sold in the winter months only. Most people were outside in the summer. So Charles Vasseur, when he was in touring Europe, was really fascinated by the Leica camera and thought, you know, we could do something cheaper, less complicated, and market it to the everyday family. He talked the local businessmen into going along with his plan. And what also helped, in 1935, Kodak invented the 35mm film, daylight films, and 36 Kodachrome was invented. So that kind of helped facilitate the beginning of 35mm cameras in this country. But the cameras were either very expensive or very cheap, so you wanted something in the middle of the road. So he hired this Belgian designer, engineer, Gustave Fassine, and with him he created the Argus A. It's a Bakelite camera body, and it was released in 1936. It was sold for $9.95. Over 30,000 units were sold in the first few weeks it was on the market. So there was a need for that, and Vasseur saw that. And they dabbled in other things like electric shavers and other small appliances, and they lost on that big time. But by 1938, they decided to go with only cameras. They sold all their rights off to the radio and just focus on cameras. Also in 1938, the Argus C, the first of the series of the Argus C, C2, C3s was introduced.
What was different about the Argus C than the previous Argus?
A little bit different lenses, basically.
Okay.
For better or for worse, the Argus C, or the C3 especially, is known as a brick because it's a huge, heavy camera, but pretty much almost indestructible. People could drop it. There were some issues with it, you know, with the lenses, but mine still works. I take it out sometimes and, oh, yeah.
And you use 35mm mm-hmm. film.
Actually, every year the Argus Collectors Group have a conference, and included in the conference is a photography contest, and everybody gets the same roll of film. Everybody has to use an Argus camera, and you go out and shoot for 3 hours and come back and see who took the best pictures.
Neat.
Yeah. In 1940, the company adopted the name International Industries Incorporated, III, which would be found in the military equipment. And in 1941, they start producing a lot of telescopes and sighting devices, prisms for the military. And by 1942, all their production was for the war effort.
Now, how many employees would it start burgeoning to?
You know, I'm not really sure. I have to look that up for you. I'm not really sure. But I know they did build other buildings around there just for the production. And one of the former employees told me that there actually was a guard walking around the factory 24/7 just for, you know, security.
Yes, we wondered about that because so much of what they were doing for the war effort was new.
Yes, and people received deferments because of the lens grinding capabilities and things like that. Yeah. So we do have quite a few of the military items on display. Besides the M72 telescope, we have an M6 periscope. We have a lot of other prisms and other sighting devices on display. And by the end of World War II, Argus had won the Army-Navy E Award 5 times, which is a award for production of excellence. Post-World War II, in 1942, it was the largest private industrial employer in Ann Arbor. And the years following the war were good ones. The Korean War came up, and they did things for the military again. They had some new cameras. They were on the market. They were only second to Kodak for camera production and film-related things like projectors and movie projectors and things like that. In 1956, Argus engineers worked with U of M Computer Systems and designed the lenses for the C-44 as one of the first commercial lenses to be designed with the aid of computers.
So the U of M partnership continued to grow as far as research and collaboration.
Yeah. But the last of the American-made cameras, the C-3, was in 1966. They continued to make movie cameras and slide projectors, but outside Ann Arbor. By 1963, Argus left the Ann Arbor building.
Now, tell us why they leave Ann Arbor.
They had
been sold to Sylvania.
Right, sold to Sylvania, and then they actually then Mansfield and back to Sylvania again. Well, I think because before 1963, they already had companies, a Canadian subsidiary in Toronto. They were making a different kind of equipment. I think they were making like the slide viewers. They had a subsidiary in Germany and South Carolina, West Columbia. They had a projector manufacturing plant. So I think once they stopped making cameras, that's why they left Ann Arbor. So the Argus name is, in 31, it was actually the International Radio Corporation. By 37, it was the International Research Corporation. In 41 or maybe 40, it was the International Industries Incorporated. And in 42, and some of the sources, 41 is what was Argus Incorporated. In 51 is Argus Cameras Incorporated. In 57 was Argus Division of Sylvania Electronic Products. And in 1959, when GTE took over, it was Argus Incorporated.
So what's just the right name?
Yes. We will just say Argus because it covers most people. Know what you're talking about then.
In Ann Arbor.
In Ann Arbor, you do at least. Yes, that's true.
Now, continuing the timeline, our articles around 1966 or so start showing real trouble and worry among the Ann Arbor community that Argus was going to be lost and closed completely, and the employees really start. When did they finally shut down and lay off the last of the employees?
You know, I'm not sure. You have to ask some of the people that, you know, you're going to interview soon that were former employees, because even though they closed the Argus building in 63, they had another building more outside of town that they still had lens grinding and that kind of stuff. And I think it's about 1970-ish, I'm pretty sure. I don't know the exact year.
A few of the employees at least went down to South Carolina,
right?
Some of the more technical people in that.
We
wanted to ask you about the building itself. How much do you know about, I mean, they didn't build it new for Argus, right?
No.
The building existed prior to Argus?
Yes. Actually, the original square part of the building was built around 1866. It was originally a wood structure that housed a cabinet-making shop. Then around 68, John Keck and his brother George, the John Keck and Company Furniture Manufacturing Company, occupied the building. And then in 1879, a four-story brick building was erected. Around 1891, the original wood structure was bricked over, and another structure built in between those first two buildings connected everything.
So is that what we see now when we walk up?
You see kind of three different sections.
Mm-hmm,
that's what you see. And then in 1905, John Keck retired. In 29, the Michigan Furniture Company ceased operations. And in 31, that's when the International Radio Corporation took over ownership. And then in 63, the University of Michigan purchased the building. In 83, First Martin Corporation and O'Neill Construction purchased the Argus One building. And in 87, O'Neill Construction opened his doors there, and the museum opened in 87.
Now, it said that during World War II, they built a separate production structure across the street. Is that still around?
Yeah, that's directly across on 4th. It was kind of a rounded corner. Mm-hmm. That was built actually in the 50s, I believe.
Oh, in the 50s.
Now, before that, they had a single-story building where the parking lot for O'Neill Construction is now. There was a single-story building there, like a glass building. They had production there, too. And actually, if you look at the front of the building, the current building, you can see tower lines where the roof line once was.
Inside, in the main building, is it structurally the same, or did they come in and gut it at some point?
They changed a lot of it because they opened up some of the first and second floor, make it like an atrium. A lot of the original bricks there, a lot of the post and beam constructions there, because you can see, it's kind of fun, you can see wood post and beam, wrought iron, steel, so you can see as the building progressed, how when it was constructed. If you go in the basement, there's steel, brick, wood. I mean, it's the whole array within 20 feet.
Do you have any of the equipment left as part of the museum that was used in manufacturing or creating lenses?
We have one saw from the furniture company, a handsaw. That's it.
What about the Argus machinery?
No. Nothing.
None of those.
No.
Now, did that get taken away to other facilities or just scrapped?
I do not know.
That would be interesting to find if they just, because it seems it would be expensive to move it all, especially if it was already getting
older.
And if they're
anyways.
Not producing the same
right.
product.
I would think some of the lens grinding stuff went down to South Carolina. But yeah, otherwise I don't know.
Now, how did Joe O'Neill get involved in the Argus? Was he a camera collector?
No, but he's interested in history and things like that. And I think he just, when he realized the significance of Argus, and it was the Argus One building, both Bill Martin, he just wanted to do something to commemorate that. And that's when they searched out this W. Donald Wallace and bought his collection out. They had no idea it was going to become what it is today.
Tell me about this Donald Wallace. How did he get interested? Was he from Michigan?
He's from the Michigan area, yes. And there's a lot of collectors of Argus cameras and Argus artifacts. They're from all over the world. I get emails from South Africa, from Saudi Arabia, France. Believe it or not, there's collectors everywhere. I'm amazed sometimes. And this was a local collector known locally and throughout Michigan for his. He collected not just Argus, but other cameras too. But he was most well known for his significant collection of Argus cameras. And they contacted him and they asked him, and he was older at the time. I think he just thought it would be a good way to keep his collection together.
Getting back to the Argus Eye, when did they start the employee newsletter? Do you know how far, or at least how far back your collection goes?
1942 to 1962. And it was first called Argus Eyes for Victory, and there was obviously emphasis on the war effort. And in 46, it was called Argus Eyes after the war was settled.
Was there an editor, or was it all completely volunteer employees doing
It was volunteer employees. It was put on by the recreational club and personal department wrote and published it. But it's also other employees could write articles and things like that, too. I mean, there was a lot of different kind of things. They had sports, club events, retirements, graduations, products, competitions, benefits about the credit union, the new cafeteria, question and answers, anniversary photos, service photos, department photos, parties, who was a new employee, and sometimes they're really not politically correct. Like, do you see the gams in that new secretary? And that was in the Argus Eyes. And so-and-so is doing her hair differently. Wonder whose eye she's trying to catch.
Do they run several shifts a day? Or
it depends, I think, what year it was. But I think when it was World War II, they were running several shifts a day.
Did many people travel from other communities to work here?
I think mostly Ann Arbor people, but what they did is, other plants, other places, too. And what I was told, too, that actually during World War II, they had a lot of people from Germany, parents came from Germany at least, working there. And there was some difficulty with that, too. But the Germans and Belgians knew a lot about lens grinding. So,
what is the name of the gentleman?
Gustav.
Oh, Bassin Gustav. Yes. We actually have a little bit about him at the museum, too. He was a really fascinating man. Something I think, and his granddaughter, actually one of the Argus collectors members, tracked down his granddaughter.
We saw that video.
Yes. Isn't that amazing?
Who is the gentleman who was speaking about?
Mike Ritzma. Who is one of the most energetic, enthusiastic Argus Collectors Group members. And he loves to do research. So he's a wonderful man.
You can tell.
Yes.
And he doesn't live here, right? He lives in California?
Yes. But he flies here sometimes to do research and participates in the conferences and things like that.
That was quite a bit of sleuthing and tracking down to come up with this gentleman's history.
No kidding.
Go through a little bit about what you know about him and how he came to Argus.
Well, like I mentioned before, Vachon solicited him to come work for Argus because he was Belgian and he was an engineer. And although Vachon has the patent for the Argus A, most people think that actually Gustav Fassin was really, really credited with designing it. He was one time vice president of Argus, in charge of engineering. and also played an integral role in the creation of the Argus III and C cameras, A3 and C cameras. He also worked for the Army Air Corps, of Explorer 1, Explorer 2, the high altitude balloons, and I think something to do with a torpedo camera too.
I noticed that.
And he was a designer. He did architect. He designed his own house.
And he painted. And
yes.
Did watercolors.
Fascinating man.
Fascinating.
Yes. I think he was good looking, too.
Don't you say that. Now, did we know why he left?
No. He moved to Rochester, New York from here, so you might have gotten a better offer. You know, Rochester's Kodak.
Right. Yeah. Do you know anything about Verschoor?
You know, I do know some stuff about him. He is kind of...
He seems like a quirky kind of
character. Was. He was known for promotional and making the fast buck. And I think one reason they let him go, actually, because he designed or was involved in a 10-tube radio, but it was awesome. You know, they all lit up. But in reality, only 5 tubes actually worked.
Was he kind of an inventor? Or he just had the ideas?
He had ideas and the knack for selling things and, you know, a salesman.
And how did they let him go? Because he founded the company.
Well, it was a board, and the board voted him out. 10 or so businessmen all found the company together. So as a board, they voted him out.
What happened to him?
You know, let me see. I do have some notes on him a little bit, I think. One of the Argus Collectors Group gentlemen...
I know
has
he
a lot
died
on him.
In 1943.
He died in Ann Arbor, too.
Yeah, he died
and
in Ann Arbor.
And he tried to, was it a telescope he wanted? Was designing something like that.
I just wonder if he has descendants and stuff. I'm just curious. He sounds like a son of a quirky character.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, the good thing about this Argus Collectors Group, they do a lot of research for me. And a lot of them have their own little specialties. So I know it's radios that go to this guy. If it's military stuff, I go to this guy. If it's advertising, this other gentleman. You know, that, so they all have their little specialty knacks. And I don't know a lot, everything, but I know where to go to find things
that's
out.
That's a good librarian. Yeah. You know where to go.
I know a little bit about a lot of it, but that's about it.
What about Mayor Brown? What do we know about him?
I never really researched him that much, truthfully, because he was only semi-involved, and, you know.
So this basically was a capital venture, like a big group of businessmen came together.
And they wanted to bring jobs during the Depression to the local area. And they did, you know. And they also brought like a cooperative spirit, I've read, to the businessmen in the local area.
And Ann Arbor State Bank was very supportive of it and did most
right.
of the financing.
Right, they did, that. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think as of 1933, they were the only privately owned company that still paid shareholders
dividends,
yeah. Mm-hmm. So they were profitable.
And, we saw articles that they have a company dinner. Everybody was treated
to. Oh, yes. They had children's Christmas parties. They had a flyers club for, you know, small airplanes. They had bowling clubs, basketball teams. Argus employees, they camped at Independence Lake. And they had baseball tournaments there and fishing tournaments. And there's a lot of pictures in the Argus Eyes about their camping and all their things they did.
And they had a very robust scholarship programs for,
yes, they did.
For the employees' children.
And the Argus company donated $10,000 to the high school for the planetarium.
Now, do you still have any connection? Do you do any programs with the planetarium?
You know what? When I had the seminar workshop last fall for Argus collectors, we did have a field trip there. And the original apparatus that was bought for the planetarium is no longer in operation, but actually it's still functional. They just couldn't find the right light bulbs to use it anymore. But it's still there.
But the planetarium is ongoing, correct? I mean,
yes.
They
oh, yeah, it's,
new
still,
equipment
still functional. Yes, yes. But I want to understand the equipment does need some work, and they're actually looking to raise funds to
And that's
update
housed
it.
In Pioneer High School,
yes,
correct?
It is. Yep. Yep.
Now, Mike mentioned Elsie's scrapbook.
Yes.
Did we ever get any glimpses of that?
He has some. He's supposed to scan that for me and give me copies.
So, that would be fascinating.
Yes.
From another perspective.
Right. Mike's an interesting guy. This past conference, he couldn't make it, but the museum's display was all about prisms and lenses. And there was some discussion among members what kind of lens configuration were different cameras. So he took his towel saw and sawed cameras in half and shipped them to me. Because you could see the different configuration.
Now, the sawed in half cameras, what became of those?
I have them.
Okay.
They're not in display yet, but they will be. I'm working on
I was going to say, that would be a great display for kids.
Oh, yeah. I'm working on how exactly to do that. Yeah.
Walk us through when you walk in the door at the museum, what a visitor will see.
Well, you walk up the door, you have to walk up the stairs or take the elevator to the second floor. And then right off the bat, you'll see cases of cameras, darkroom equipment, some kind of interesting little items. One is a ceiling projector. It was manufactured during World War II, so injured soldiers who were bedbound could project books and film strips on the ceiling. Yeah, you'll see some military items. You'll see some human interest stuff. And if someone wants to make an appointment, they can come into the archives and look through all our Argus eyes and photographs and
now, do you have documents. Any company documents?
Yes.
You do?
Mm-hmm. Mostly engineering documents. I have some sketches, things like that, too.
So sketches from patent applications mm-hmm. and that type of thing.
How did you get those?
Some were just left there. Some employees had copies of. Some people just donate what they had.
Did they ever go through a period where employees wore uniforms? Because we were surprised when we saw the World War II one that people were all just dressed right off the street.
I don't think there's no uniforms. All they had was badges. So it was kind of a family-orientated type company, the feel of his family.
Was there a cafeteria?
Yes. Yep.
There was.
So does anybody has the menu?
You know, I do have some things, especially when they opened the new cafeteria, I think it was maybe like 46 or something. But they do list what was there for the week.
Do they eat free, for free?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Maybe we'll ask
the employees that. Yeah, it's a good question. I could know that too.
I wonder if the cafeteria was open the whole time the business was
certain lunch hours. But they did. They served breakfast, too. I know they had breakfast items there, too. They talked about the sweet rolls and things like that. So,
but it appears from both the eyes and other documents that social life was really
woven in an
important part of the whole company experience.
Oh, yes, definitely. So like family. And I think when they closed their doors, people were, you know, besides losing their jobs, they lost parts of their family. That's why I think some of these employees, you know, years and years later, still keep in contact with each other.
Now, we hear and we see that generations of a family will work for Argus.
Right.
And is it hard to get a job at Argus?
I'm not sure. If your brother worked there, it would be easier for you to get a job because he would come in and say, my wife worked there, my brother worked there, my sister-in-law worked there. You know, so it must have been if they knew you were a good worker and you had someone else who wanted to work.
And they obviously pay well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And as you say, it was during the Depression the largest employer in Ann Arbor,
yes.
One of the few employers of anybody with any skilled trades.
Right.
So it's an important part of the local history.
Correct. And actually national history, too, because Argus really was instrumental in the whole culture of the 35mm cameras and the family snapshots. Before that time, really, before the early 30s, it was mostly professionals.
We'd like to thank Cheryl for getting together with AADL to talk about the Argus Museum. For more information on the history of Argus Camera, please visit ONews at onews.aadl.org. Music for this episode was Strolling by Alan Marchand off his Blues for All Occasions album, which you can find on the AADL catalog by going to aadl.org/magnitudes. AADL Talks to Argus Camera has been a production of the Ann Arbor District Library.